for another perspective on what seems to be a lot more complicated and interesting disease than maybe we remembered from a decade ago, I met with Dr. John Kirkwood, who began our conversation by discussing non-protocol management of patients with metastatic disease.
The only agent, when you ask me today, is there a standard of therapy for patients with metastatic disease, I would say interleukin-2, which was approved in 1998 for the treatment of metastatic melanoma. But we all recognize that's an agent which was approved on the basis of a compilation of phase 2 trials, has never, ever been compared to any other agent, and never, ever been subjected to a phase 3 trial. So we have few things to offer our patients with metastatic melanoma that we can reliably say we know have an impact. Of course, the reason why IL-2 was approved for the treatment of melanoma is that it induces durable and complete remissions in a small fraction, perhaps one-third of the people who respond. If 16% of people respond, maybe 5 or 6% have these durable, meaningful, hopefully curative responses. But that's a very small piece of the pie, and I think we know that we would like to do much better. So, you know, our understanding of the single adjuvant therapy, which we have for people with high-risk resected melanoma, interferon alpha, we've spent 25 years working on that agent. We now can say with great comfort that this is an immunotherapy, that it works by knocking out the constitutively activated STAT3, which seems to poison the environment for the host immune system in the tumor. We know that it drives T cells into the tumor and drives dendritic cells into the tumor, does a whole bunch of good things for the immunotherapy of melanoma. But in the adjuvant arena, it only reduces relapses by perhaps one-third, a hazard ratio 1.5 in the way we portray these, or a hazard ratio 0.7, 0.8, the way people otherwise understand those figures. And we need to do better there, too. Happily, there is a consistency between interleukin-2 and interferon alpha. They both induce durable responses. They both are immunotherapies, we presume. They both induce autoimmunity. And in the people who develop autoimmunity, we see the highest likelihood of response. So there's been great excitement over the last 4 or 5 years in relation to antibodies that do similar things, so-called anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, the cytotoxic T lymphocyte antigen 4, of course, is the brakes on the immune system. Antibodies to CTLA-4 have been taken forward in huge phase 3 and phase 2 trials. And those two approaches, I think, have been a major hope for the future that has come in part to some fruition this ASCO this last year. So we, I think, have a rapidly moving field. I think we need to understand more about these advances with things like the antibodies to CTLA-4. But I think there are new tools to implement to bring to bear upon this disease.
What happened at ASCO in terms of this?
So at ASCO, I think we saw a series of presentations on ipilimumab, which is, of course, what was called MDX-010. One of those interesting presentations tested three different doses that showed in a phase 2 setting that the higher the dose, the more likely the efficacy. And I think that data from Hamid was a very interesting, small but meaningful presentation. Jeff Weber presented a large study of ipilimumab with budesonide, attempting to overcome the major toxicity that we see with this agent, which is, of course, a colitis-like reaction and autoimmune, perhaps, immune response to commensal organisms that we all have in the bowel that triggers really very severe diarrheal diathesis that's required colectomy in some patients and has been refractory to systemic steroids in some patients who have actually had mortality from this. Unfortunately, the study of budesonide shows not one iota of evidence that it really alters that colitis reaction. And so I think we're still working on ways to make this drug more palatable, a more tolerable drug. In terms of the phase 3 and the phase 2 trials, Tony Rebus presented in a late-breaking abstract the phase 3 study of tremelimumab. And there, the intended primary objective of overall survival was not prolonged by the margin that had been hoped for. To be sure, the tremelimumab gave a survival outcome that was better than the reference arm of dacarbazine or temozolomide, since it was either of those that was allowed. But it was only a month better, and that 1 month better was nowhere close to what people had hoped for this agent in that phase 3 trial. In looking back at the data for that study, I think we can wonder about trial design, because the trial design involved first the cutting out the exclusion of patients with LDH elevated over twofold normal. I think all of the audience will know that in the earlier trials of Genta with Genesense and Dacarbazine that we presented to the ASCO 3 years ago, it looked as though that intervention had its entire benefit in people who had less than 1.1 or twofold elevated LDH, that is to say the best actors in the population of patients that we see. But when you do a big phase 3 trial of an agent like anti-CTLA-4 and you cut out the high LDH patients, you also cut out events. You make your comparator arm, in this case temozolomide or dacarbazine, look a lot better. So the median survival for patients was vastly better with temozolomide dacarbazine than what he'd expected. That at 10.7 months was bested by 1 month, 11.7 months with tremelimumab. But perhaps this is an unintended approach that may have reduced the threshold of difference that one could see with tremelimumab. Otherwise, we know that at least 10% and perhaps much more than that of the population that was assigned to receive dacarbazine or temozolomide, since this was an open label study, then had access to crossover therapy with the compassionate exemption release of ipilimumab, the other anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibody. And when 10% of a population of patients assigned to the dacarbazine temozolomide got treated, as we now know they were treated in second, you know, later phase with the competitor anti-CTLA-4, it also may have confounded the outcome. But I think the phase 2 has taught us that there are still these durable responses. 16 patients, 7% of the 242 patients in the phase 2 trial that I led for the phase 2 second line therapy with tremelimumab had very durable responses. 15 of 16 of those responses are ongoing and of substantially longer duration than we expect from any of the standard chemotherapy agents. So the real question, I think, is where to go with these agents, with tremelimumab in particular. And I think combinations are the answer. One other paper that we presented at the meeting was the combination of high-dose interferon alpha and high-dose tremelimumab for metastatic melanoma. The first 16 patients have shown us several major responses. We have two of those ongoing out past 6 months. And in that particular experience, there was a very tight correlation between the induction of autoimmunity, vitiligo-like depigmentation, colitis, other manifestations of the typical autoimmune sort that we've seen, and the induction of major responses with this combination. So I think we're looking forward to seeing future combinations of the other immunomodulator antibodies. Obviously, there are co-stimulatory antibodies like the CD137 antibody that Bristol-Myers Squibb have, and that in combination with ipilimumab will be a very promising combination to look at.
For an oncologist in community-based practice, what do you consider sort of reasonable non-protocol algorithms, both in the metastatic setting and also in terms of adjuvant therapy? What are the treatments that you think are reasonable for an oncologist to offer right now outside a protocol setting?
So for a patient who presents who is either not eligible for protocols or for whom one cannot gain access to protocol, I think we'll need to see what the outcome of the carboplatin-paclitaxel ECOG study that has closed accrual in April with more than 800 patients aboard. But clearly, the combination of carboplatin-paclitaxel is a very active combination. This, of course, was the root combination that Keith Flaherty had tested in his original trials with sorafenib at Penn. And there, as I think all of the audience will know, the use of sorafenib, at least in second-line patients, added nothing to the benefit of carboplatin plus paclitaxel. But carboplatin-paclitaxel gave a median progression-free survival of more than 4 months. That 4-month PFS interval for carboplatin, I think, may well mean that that's a new standard of chemotherapy. And so for us, at least for patients who don't have access to protocols, who are able to withstand that aggressive combination, that is a useful regimen. I think that we offer high-dose IL-2 to all patients up front. I think that wherever that's available and can be administered, it is a very reasonable first-line offering, and we would actually recommend that before any of the chemotherapy agents for a patient who's young and wants a shot at the long-term benefit that is available from IL-2.
You mentioned carboplatin, and in a number of tumors, particularly breast cancer, we're seeing trials looking at nab-paclitaxel. What do we know about nab and melanoma?
Not much. I think that's something certainly to be further explored. But I think right now we're gratified that the impact, maybe a 40% response rate if one takes Keith Flaherty's data, is a very respectable response rate, and that the PFS benefit is better than we've seen with almost anything we've tested ever in large numbers of patients before.
Can you talk a little bit more about exactly what BRAF is and how sorafenib or other agents affect it?
Sure. Well, BRAF, of course, part of the MAP kinase pathway, one of the major drivers of many tumor types. The mutation of BRAF that activates this whole pathway, recognized and already published back 5-6 years ago, has been the impetus, as I mentioned before, for the study of sorafenib. Unfortunately, sorafenib is far more an inhibitor of CRAF than BRAF, and we know that it has many other functions, inhibitory functions on the PDGF pathway that may play a role in its benefit in melanoma as well. But I think it tells us that melanoma is a heterogeneous disease. It's a disease where the events at the tumor cell level may be quite diverse in different subcategories of disease that we have hitherto lumped all together, and maybe in so doing may have lost our ability to see the impact of specific targeted interventions. I think the interesting thing about BRAF mutations and our studies of atypical nevi are that we see BRAF mutated even in atypical nevi. So the role of BRAF in and of itself cannot be the single driver, because it's already on, it's already mutated in the atypical nevi that we see in great numbers of patients, perhaps 7% of the population. So it is other things. It is multiple events, multiple lesions that likely drive this tumor. And in the end, I think that takes us to a conclusion that we're all coming to, which is that it'll be multiple therapies. It'll be combinations that make sense. That whole discussion pertains to the tumor cell, but we, I think, recognize that there's a very complex interaction between the host and the tumor in this disease, perhaps more pertinent than in many other tumors, that the constitutive activation of STAT3, which we have already discovered a decade ago and published then, is clearly seen in melanomas as part of this interaction which suppresses the host response, eliminates, tolerizes the host response. And so tolerance is a major phenomenon in melanoma that needs to be addressed. I think it is perhaps the explanation for two of the most confusing presentations last year and this year at our ASCO meetings, where vaccines, which I think most of us and most of our audience would have said could not have hurt our patients, they might not have helped, but they certainly wouldn't have been toxic and wouldn't have hurt our patients. Vaccines may in fact do exactly the wrong things when they're not monitored for the immunological effects that they have. In the particular setting of the Canvaxin trial that was conducted and reported by Donald Morton a year ago, the finding reported at ASCO last year and now heading its way to press, is that vaccination of patients with stage 3 node-positive resected disease seems to have increased the mortality rate by 9%, a statistically significant increase in the mortalities of people who got the vaccine over patients who did not get the vaccine with BCG. And that was actually followed up by a presentation at the ASCO meetings this year for a more chemically defined vaccine, the GMK vaccine, which the EORTC tested in a large trial of more than 1,300 patients in earlier disease, the same disease category we're talking about 1 month of interferon for, the stage 2 populations, stage 2A, 2B. In that trial, there were 20 more deaths in the recipients of the vaccine than in the observed population. That difference actually made statistical significance in their analysis and led them to shut down this trial early. However, that's a very early result, and I think we all ought to take that with a grain of salt, because, in fact, the relapse-free differences between the groups did not track with the mortality events. The distant metastasis-free rates between the observed and the treated populations did not track. But I think it tells us that this whole family of agents, the anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, which may reset, re-regulate the immune system, may well play a bigger role in conjunction with vaccines than given alone, and that vaccines perhaps are a double-edged sword, and that administered without other agents to, if you will, polarize the immune system or turn it on from the tolerant setting that it may have reached in patients with advanced disease, we may not do benefit with vaccines, but only hasten the retreat of the troops, allow the progression of the disease, if you will.
Any hypothesis about why, you know, maybe an adverse effect potentially could be seen?
Well, I think the induction of T regulatory cells is a very broadly recognized phenomenon in immunology now. This occurs with interleukin-2 and was reported already 4 or 5 years ago with IL-2, which is clearly an effective agent in a subset of patients. We have documented and recently published that Treg cells go up with interferon alpha, but there may be a bigger picture here in what is going on. But if a vaccine induces regulatory, if you will, tolerizing T cell response, one needs to abrogate that before vaccination can be effective, and that is part at least of the goal of agents like anti-CTLA-4 and the ONTAC antibody as well. So I think we'll see combinations of vaccines that are perhaps more carefully monitored, and certainly combinations with agents like these immunoregulatory antibodies that we've just been talking about.
You mentioned sorafenib. Can you talk about the clinical research that's been reported with that agent in melanoma?
Yeah, the biggest clinical research conducted with sorafenib in melanoma is, of course, the frontline phase 3 ECOG trial E2603 that was just closed for accrual in April of this year. You know, that trial assigned patients to carboplatin, paclitaxel, and placebo on the one arm, and carboplatin, paclitaxel, and sorafenib on the other arm. That trial, as I mentioned, accrued over 800 patients to April when it was closed, and the jury is still out on that trial. But basically, the clinical research there has included not only the clinical experience, but now a study by array techniques using the blocks of patients who entered that trial, which will ask very much more complex questions about what the impact of sorafenib upon the patient may have had to do with the full picture of the genetic events that are going on or have gone on in the tumor tissue of those patients.
Can you talk about the research that led up to the development of that phase 3 trial and what was seen that encouraged people to look at this?
Certainly. Well, I think the research that Keith Flaherty and his group at Penn did using a regimen that was originally targeted at lung cancer, of course, and that's the reason why carboplatin and paclitaxel were utilized there, added sorafenib when it became clear that the V600E mutation was a very prevalent one in common, you know, garden variety melanoma that we all see in our clinics. And so Keith accrued a substantial number of patients, ultimately more than 120 patients that he has reported upon, with a response rate of 40% and a progression-free survival rate of over 8 months that was truly remarkable because, as I mentioned, when we looked at our phase 2 experience across the country in the last 35 years, 70 phase 2 trials, the progression-free survival rate is usually not past the second time one looks at your patients. In fact, at 6 months, only 15% of patients on average would remain progression-free. At 1 year in phase 2 trials, 30% of patients only would be alive. And so Keith's experience compared very favorably to that multi-center cooperative group experience, I think led us to say in 2005, when this data was first presented to the international groups, the large melanoma meetings, that this was ready for a phase 3 trial. And so very rapidly that trial was written, it was implemented, and I have to say the country at large participated extremely effectively in that trial with accrual rates over 35 patients a month to the study until its accrual goal was met. We'll need to wait because the goal was not just response rate but also survival, and that will probably take us into next year to see the results. But those will be robust data when they become available. I think, you know, we will hope that they show us a way forward, a positive way forward. Clearly, if they don't, if sorafenib does not add in the first-line therapy of metastatic melanoma, they may well, as we talked about earlier, they may have brought forward a new standard of double-agent chemotherapy, which is easily administered, induces progression-free survival up to 4 months in patients with second-line treatment.
Do you think there's a role right now? I mean, obviously, sorafenib is available to clinicians. Is there any role right now for its use in a non-protocol setting in patients with melanoma?
I personally think that we really need to continue to explore new agents. I think we should all wait for the data from the phase 3 trial. I think in the patient who has failed one regimen, it is already very clear that sorafenib adds nothing to carboplatin paclitaxel and that we probably don't have any basis to couple those targeted and standard chemotherapeutic agents after failure of any other regimen. It should be mentioned that interesting, encouraging data for the combination of sorafenib and dacarbazine or temozolomide have been adduced. Again, these have not been tested and reported in phase 3, but I think there are other combinations that have not been fully explored either in second or in first line, and I think we probably need to wait for those before we make decisions.
So again, in a patient who's, you know, down the line, third, fourth line therapy, any role for sorafenib?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that at the present time, we don't see the major effects that have been for renal cell cancer seen with this agent or with hepatoma. I think on the other side, at the ASCO meetings this year, axitinib, a new pan-VEGF receptor inhibitor that was presented by Fruhoff, achieved effects that we all, I think, stood up and took notice from. I think the response rate there, 20% in patients who were treated in that work that was presented to the plenary session for melanoma, are as exciting as anything we have in terms of new agents. And the phase 2 larger study is actually being now discussed as a possibility for axitinib, which of course has also interesting results in renal cell cancer that may well bring it forward and make it of interest across the board.
What about the role of agents targeting heat shock protein? What do we know about that in melanoma?
So there have been large trials of the HSP96, which is a chaperone protein, of course, that is important for presentation of antigens, dendritic cell response, and T cell response. And Affirm Antigenics has actually taken the heat shock protein approach to a very, very high level with centers for the processing of tumor tissue, the extraction of heat shock proteins located in the U.S. and in other countries that were the base for taking autologous tumor from patients, turning it into vaccine that would then be possible to use as a therapeutic agent for those same patients. Unfortunately, I think the impact has been across the board less than we had hoped it would be. There are subset analyses that suggested benefit in subgroups of patients, but in the overview, the impact of this as a single approach to therapy is not sufficient to allow us to now recommend that.
Any cases that you've taken care of that you think, you know, might be instructive to bring up here that try to give a better overall feel about sort of where things are heading in the disease?
Sure. Well, I think we've been here in Pittsburgh for 23 years, and one of the patients I treated in the second year I was here was a young man from West Virginia who had widespread metastatic melanoma. And in those days, of course, it was the halcyon days of the first IL-2 trials, and we treated him, of course, with IL-2. And then Steve Rosenberg said it was really lymphokine-activated killer cells that we should give, and we treated him, of course, with adherence-purified lymphokine-activated killer cells. Still no benefit. And then we treated him with, it was carboplatin dacarbazine we were testing plus tamoxifen. And of course, he had a flicker of a response with that. And he then progressed through that. And then we, of course, radiated symptomatic disease. And about at that point in time, he began to develop vitiligo. And we actually took his blood and looked at his lymphocytes. And with one of the investigators in our group who'd come from the Ludwig Institute, Dr. Hassan Zarour, we actually looked at this gentleman's tissue type. And many oncologists out there will be perplexed with us because we often ask them to tissue type their patients because it's only when we know the class 1 tissue type, in particular HLA-A2, where most of the vaccines are developed for melanoma because it happens to be 40% of what we see for the tissue types of our patients with melanoma. But we were actually at that point in time already beginning to think about the helper T cell populations, and this young man was a DR4, a class 2 type that was not infrequent, but allows us, in fact, to look at his helper T cells. And because we had at that point in time been looking at responses to what is called melan A, which is one of the lineage antigens of melanoma, we actually asked whether his blood might react to any of the antigens that we had isolated out of the melan A molecule Turned out his blood at the point of time that he developed a spontaneous complete response of this disease showed us a clonal population of CD4 T cells targeted on an epitope, a piece of the protein of melanin A, known as the melanin A 51 to 73 epitope. No surprise to you, that actually is now part of the vaccine portfolio that we're testing and testing in the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group's vaccine trials for advanced melanoma. But this young man who had a spontaneous complete response of his disease had a clonal population of T cells that he had been smart enough to develop in reaction to this marker of his own melanoma. And I think that tells me that looking much more carefully at the immune response to this disease, I told you earlier, and I think it's going to be of interest to all of your audience, that patients develop thyroiditis, hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism. But you know, and I know, that it cannot possibly be that hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, or autoimmunity to the thyroid gland has anything to do with melanoma outcome. Rather, it's very likely, I think, that the patients who develop those autoimmune reactions are the people who develop a meaningful response to an antigen we have yet to define. And so I think the future in this field is not only the targeted therapies that hit the tumor cell at its many susceptible points that I know Keith went through before, but it's also looking at the antigens that may be the targets recognized in patients treated with IL-2, in patients treated with interferon alpha, in patients treated with anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibodies. And I think when we're really smart, when we're out of this halfway technology that we're in with things like interferon, interleukin, and CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, we'll know the antigen, which is the key antigen in our patients to actually use for vaccine purposes.
So this patient had a spontaneous complete response?
He did.
And what happened?
He's actually still alive in West Virginia. He had metastatic disease really from the top of his head to the bottom of his toes when we first saw him. And he is now free of disease in West Virginia, doing very well, actually just built a house and actually got divorced and remarried and has children.
So how long ago was it that this happened?
That was 19 years ago.
Wow. How many times have you observed something like that?
Oh, we have dozens of patients like this, each different anecdotes. I mean, people that we used to think were having a response to dacarbazine, the very few of them that did have responses to dacarbazine, I really think had the teeter-totter unbalanced by dacarbazine. You know, if tumor makes immunosuppressive factors and we can get rid of enough of it, maybe the teeter-totter is tipped in the favor of the host. I think ultimately when we come to use chemotherapy in this disease, it may well be to get rid of enough tumor that the host immune system has a chance to respond through these other mechanisms we were talking about.
Any patients who've had, you know, dramatic or prolonged responses to some of the new strategies and new agents you've been talking about today?
We, to be sure, have a number who have had the anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibody tremelimumab who have had responses. We actually have responses to the co-stimulatory antibody known as anti-CD137 that have been extremely interesting to us. I think we've seen responses to both of the anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, and I am, you know, personally a believer that that is a real modality. The trick there, like the trick for each of the agents we've been talking about, is to figure out in which patients will this work effectively, and that's really the next agenda for us to find out.